Welcome to our little chit chat today with Adil Raja. Adil, I think we're going to talk about in a bit of detail some of the shenanigans over Christmas and the New Year and the recent developments about that. But I'd like to start by asking you about the sort of political context of all of this, the geopolitical context of it, which is really to do with at the moment we see a flotilla of, well, a carrier strike group heading for Iran. The Islamic Republic. It up until the imprisonment of Imran Khan, many people talked about Pakistan as an Islamic Republic. That is to say, of God-fearing people. So I wonder if you could just explain why some people now say that Pakistan is no longer really an Islamic Republic after what's been happening to Imran.
Yeah, Tony, thank you for asking me this very important question because not a lot of people talk about it. Although the overall makeup of the Pakistani regime right now, being led by a military de facto ruler, the military dictator, whatsoever you may like to call him, he's promoted himself the field marshal. I call him the field marshal, Asim Munir, and his puppet government. Why we call the government a puppet government? It's a very important context to it. Because the government in place right now has been installed after rigging the elections and stealing the public mandate. Why are we saying this? Because the suppressed report by the Commonwealth Observation Group was leaked by a whistleblower like us, and that proved the point. Before that, the election was conducted by the civilian administration and the commissioner of the Rawalpindi District Division, in fact. He himself came forward and said the election was entirely rigged. The actual election results are noted down in a form called Form 45. But they were changed manually overnight. The online system was brought down, and a new form, as the final result, was brought out on Form 47, which are entirely rigged. But the Pakistani judiciary is not independent to go on and call a suo motu action and investigate it. Obviously, the judiciary, the Islamabad, the High Court, the Pakistani High Court judges have complained to the Chief Justice that the Pakistani military and the Pakistani intelligence, the ISI, have abducted our immediate family. And in certain cases, they have, in fact, electrocuted their private parts as well. And the judges also complain in writing to the Supreme Court, to the Chief Justice, that there have been cameras inside our rooms, in our bedrooms, and we have been filmed with our wives while, sleeping. Yeah. And while, of course, what marital relationship is. But that is beyond any standard, below the belt. And that is what is going on in Pakistan. And through such shenanigans, they've been able to install a puppet regime, but overall the military is ruling. They do present in Pakistan, it is a mullah and military alliance ruling the country. Still, religion, Islam is being sold as the driving force for this regime. And the country is still called the Islamic Republic of Pakistan, but actually on ground, they're willing to sell their morals, their religion, their beliefs for to the highest bidder. They've become a mercenary state. That is the appropriate word to say. So moving forward, you're saying the armada is there. President Trump said it is the armada.
Well, he will call it an armada, but that's spin. We know this is a carrier strike group, and that the intention is most likely to blockade this country, which is many thousands of miles away from the United States.
Overall, in the geopolitical context, it's all, in my opinion, it is all linked because the Venezuelan attack, President Trump applied the same tactic. He moved the military, the U.S. Navy, the U.S. forces over there, and everybody was saying, "Well, what is he doing? This aggressive, this an act of aggression." Venezuelan was making tall claims like the Iranians are making, but it went on for a while, and everybody was saying that, "Well, it's not going to happen. The attack is not going to happen." But that achieved an element of surprise, and he went into Venezuela, abducted Maduro, and obviously people inside the Venezuelan army were involved, as things turned out to be. But what happened over there was that the ultimate aim was the Venezuelan oil, right? And President Trump is not making any secret of it. He is talking to the oil majors. And the oil majors are saying, listen, at the present rate of the oil, around $60 a barrel, it is not possible for us to invest in the Venezuelan oil infrastructure, which is depleted, which is very old. Of course, there are proven reserves, global, the biggest reserves of oil over there, but it requires hundreds of billions of dollars of investment. And of course, it is going to generate a lot of jobs for the Americans. But at the present rate of the oil, the present price of the oil, it is not feasible investment. So if Strait of Hormuz, where right now USS Abraham Lincoln is, and where the carrier strike group is, and calling it an armada. Armada lost the English and it sank, but I don't know why he's saying that. But because of the U.S. military presence in the Strait of Hormuz, and if the Strait of Hormuz is blocked, so the oil prices will skyrocket to a place where investment of hundreds of billions of dollars in Venezuela would be feasible. But it has to stay there for quite some time. So we're looking at what, a global meltdown maybe? Then it is killing the two birds with one stone for President Trump. Firstly, it solves the issue of the hundreds of billions of dollars of investment in Venezuelan oil infrastructure. Secondly, Chinese are getting their oil supply, 40 to 50% of it. They were getting it from Venezuela, got canceled. Americans are in charge over there. And the rest is coming, mostly is coming for the economy, is coming from Middle East. So if Strait of Hormuz is blocked, it means the Chinese oil supply is blocked. So the only outlet would be Russia, of course, and they're getting dirt cheap oil from there. But obviously that can be attacked, that route can be attacked. That's only a singular target which needs to be attacked by the Ukrainians, of course, by giving them precision ammunition to attack those supply lines. So obviously it works for President Trump, and it does make a lot of sense that he achieves an element of surprise and he goes for Iran, no matter the end goal over here. But definitely the oil prices will rise and it's going to work for the U.S.
Yeah, so the Spanish Armada didn't do too well. Many people talk about the old-fashioned battleships, aircraft carriers as an old type of military force. Obviously, soldiers on the ground, there's no substitute for them apart from maybe Elon Musk's androids. But these are apparently, I mean, maybe you can help me out here, because I've heard that these ships are actually quite easy to sink. So the Spanish Armada was sunk. Do you think the American Armada might be sunk too?
Well, once you're terming it an armada, that is a very telling thing. I don't think President Trump is very up to date on his history. That was a mistake to call it an armada, or maybe he's trying to create the media circus. He loves that. He's been in media throughout his life, so he knows how to manipulate that. Maybe that's the point. But talking purely from a military point of view, with myself as a former military officer, what I would say is that looking at the sheer if you look at Strait of Hormuz, it's a very narrow passageway. And the most important passageway or the most important energy corridor for the world, if it is blocked, no matter by Iranian action or the U.S. action, it is going to have an impact. First, secondly, coming to your question, well, the Iranians have said that we've got supersonic missiles, and they have proved it once they attacked Israel and Tel Aviv recently. And they have been able to hit Tel Aviv irrespective of the Iron Dome, the much famed, much boosted about Iron Dome air defense system. Americans, I'm sure, are not taking it lightly. They've got a concentration of forces. And recently we have seen the kind of military activity we have seen in the Middle East, and that we have seen American air assets in the record numbers moving to their bases in Qatar, in Bahrain, and in the Strait of Hormuz. And it reminds us of the military buildup. In fact, it is much bigger buildup than the buildup we had seen in Venezuela. And for the first time, now this is very interesting. From where is this carrier strike group coming from, the USS Abraham Lincoln? It is coming from the South China Sea. Now, that is first development. Second, Pentagon, out of the blue, maybe for deception purposes, which is a military which is a military trade craft, I would say, they said that China is not our priority target. No more our priority target. That's what the Pentagon said, right? So maybe there's an understanding. If not an understanding, they want to give an impression to the Chinese because the Chinese don't want to open a front. They want to concentrate on their economic development. And their model of, I won't say imperialism, but influence in this great power rivalry is much different from the U.S. Model of pure aggression and use of military force. The Chinese are using economic influence as a leverage of influence around the globe. So yeah, there are two, three different things. Now, whether China, whether Iran can do it or not, well, Iran's got the capability, but I'm sure before that attack, like the attack on Venezuela, the air defense system were taken down or and attacked. So there will be an attack on the air defense and the missile infrastructure of Iran, and the radar systems would be jammed through an electromagnetic spectrum. Now, Chinese military planes are reportedly coming to Tehran to counter that eventuality. Let's see where it goes. But Chinese have got the capability, the satellite capability. If they choose to provide it to Tehran, they can bypass the jamming, electromagnetic spectrum jamming of the Americans. But it is a developing situation. I'm sure the Americans are not going to risk it till the time they're not sure that they would achieve their targets, whatsoever they are.
Okay, well, look, maybe there's an element of pantomime here, because the modern missile technology, anti-ship missile technology, is quite capable, or as I understand it, of taking down military ships and tankers alike. So if someone decides, even remotely, they don't have to be floating around in the Straits of Hormuz or even nearby, they could close that strait anytime they want.
That's true, because it's so narrow, and because of the supersonic missiles are very difficult to intercept. So it is a very likely outcome that and the Iranians have proven that they're going to go to the extreme measures. So if they're going to go to that kind of an extreme measures, of course America will retaliate. They're not going to sit quiet. There'll be carpet bombing of the entire Iranian infrastructure. Now, the question for the Iranians to decide is that whether they are willing to afford that kind of reaction, because Israel fighting with Israel is one thing. Israel does not have that kind of capability without U.S. support to strike back, the kind of capability and the kind of force which the U.S. has. So it's a question for Iran to decide.
No, well, look, also, of course, we saw in the Red Sea, we saw the military ships from the United States and the UK have to sort of pull out, really. They were getting harassed by the Yemenis. So do you think Yemen has got a part to play in this potentially?
In this particular situation, Tony, Yemen is now under the control of Saudi Arab, effectively under the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, is effectively controlling it, and they want the state to survive. And the state forces are under their control. So hopefully Yemen won't be a problem. Yeah, there are Iranian proxy elements present there, but they're not,
you call them proxy elements, but I mean, many people looking at this situation just see them as natural allies. I mean, they've had this, Anglo-Zionist empire interfering in the Middle East for many years, and some populations have just got together and decided we've had enough. So when you say proxy, do you mean a mixture of some Iranian forces and their own homegrown Yemeni forces? Because they clearly have got an allied cause here.
Well, that's a fair assessment, Tony. I would give you that. Yeah, you're right. They're allies. They're Iranian allies. And if you want to call Israel a proxy of the U.S., then of course they're proxies, right? Well, if you want to call Israel an ally of the U.S., well, then they are also allies. I'm only being fair here. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's just the language that's used often in the Western media. Can you just give us a brief assessment from your point of view of what's been going on in Iran? Because I'm seeing all sorts of what I would call propaganda coming out about the government killing its own people, just as we got before the regime change in Libya. The same sort of thing as we were getting in Syria around about the same time, 2011, 2012 time. So is the Iranian government just killing its own people? And is it a good idea, do you think, to just remove the government because they're a menace to their own population?
Well, Tony, I'll be very careful answering this, but because I'm sitting in London, right? But let me tell you something, frankly and honestly. If you want to, if someone says that Iranian government or Iranian regime is not an authoritarian regime or an authoritarian government, well, I think that'll be a very unfair or very biased assessment. Iranian government is an authoritarian state. Having said that, and Iranian government has openly fired on the protesters asking for democracy. It is a given. If you're going to, you know, refute this fact, then you're not being fair. Having said that, Iranian regime is a product of the circumstances of the sanctions of the West over last 3 or 4 decades after the Shah of Iran was taken out. If they were allowed to operate as a member of the international community, I'm sure democracy must have been introduced in that country. But once you're sanctioned from right, left, and center, and you've got enemies in the entire region, because obviously it's a sectarian divide as well. The Shia-Sunni divide is there as well. And of course, the Saudis don't want war in Iran, but it is Saudis are leading the Sunni divide. And the rest of the Middle East, other than Iran, is mostly Sunni dominated. And there are pockets of influence of Iran throughout Middle East. But because of the sanctions and because of the making of the U.S. as an enemy to Iran, the product which now we see after 5 decades of sanctions and aggressive actions is on ground. And without an authoritarian government, they would not have been able to survive as well, the way they're surviving.
Yeah. Ooh, well, maybe it's the West's fault. Maybe the West has forced this sort of regime. But anyway, I mean, we've seen evidence from Iran is that there's been hundreds of police killed as well, and that there are foreign intelligence elements there. This is the sort of thing that I mean, Syria, again, had to be a very authoritarian country because there were lots of foreign intelligence agencies in Syria trying to destabilize it and eventually, of course, fomenting a regime change. So just give you I'll give you the final word on Iran, because I do see them as also targeted very much with people on the ground, on the streets by the West there.
Well, the final word is what you're saying, taking from what you're saying, this is not a secret. I've done programs on it in Urdu and Hindi, that Mossad is operating inside Iran. Mossad is operating a vast network, and they're not making a secret of it. They have said repeatedly, they've made movies and they've put them on Netflix that say, yeah, we are operating over there, because it is a war going on, and the modern war is a war of proxy or allies, whatsoever you may like to call them. But this is the war we are fighting. So Iranians have got networks, not as much as they would like to in Israel, but Israel has got a very strong network. Mossad, the Israeli intelligence, have got a very strong network in Iran, and they are working towards a regime change, definitely. But they do find sympathizers. That is why the Iran, which was in the days of the Shah, was very different. Of course, the poor were poor back then, and they're poor now. But the modern people who are partying in Lebanon and who are partying in London, well, they're a very different kind of breed, you know. They want to change in this present regime, which is...
Well, yeah, look, I would say also, look, if the British government or regime, whatever you want to call it, if the British regime was more pro-Palestinian campaigning and, for example, stopping arms supplies to Israel, you might find the Mossad operating on British streets. And in which case, there will be a lot of people who would be easy to recruit, because there's a lot of people in Britain who are anti-Keir Starmer and anti the British government. So a lot of this seems to hinge on whether your government or your regime, whatever you want to call it, is pro-Israel or anti-Israel as to whether the Mossad are going to be interfering. I'm sure there are other intelligence services, but the Mossad seems to be a very active one. Now, look, anyway, I want to bring you back to talk about what's been happening with you, because maybe you could just explain briefly why you are in kind of in exile now in London and how your family are in Pakistan.
Well, Tony, I'm undergoing a series of transnational repression, starting from Imran Khan's removal from power through a regime change operation led by the military, because and with the blessings of the Western powers, the US, I'm sure the UK gave their blessing at that time. So Imran Khan is removed from power through a vote of no confidence, but the parties which were brought into power, the prime minister which was brought into power, his son which was brought into power, both were facing serious charges of money laundering, and they were supposed to be indicted. But the day before being indicted, they were put as prime minister and chief minister. So it was a system failure. And I started speaking against it once I was in Pakistan. As a result, I was hunted down. I was attacked by my own, being a third generation Pakistan Army officer, having worked with the closely worked with the Pakistani intelligence, the ISI. Well, they told me to take a U-turn on my ideological and principled stance of supporting Imran Khan and join forces with them and speak against Imran Khan in support of the corrupt puppet regime they were implanting. So I refused to be part of that hypocrisy, that crime to the people of my country. And I spoke against it and I wrote against it. And that's why I became a target. So I escaped in April of 2022 to the UK. And my UK is the second home I'll always have been for my family since the 1950s. My wife and my kids were already here. I was a British resident. That's why. So I escaped overnight, because I was supposed to come to the UK anyway to spend Eid with my family, immediate family, with my children and my wife, of course, but and the extended family. But well, the attacks were so intense that I had to escape overnight, and I was the first one to escape. And I took a flight via Doha, and I reached the UK, and I kept on. I'm sorry, and I kept on.
Hang on a second. Let's just leave it silent for 10 seconds. You just carry on. Until a bit
more. Yeah. Sorry for that. Sorry for the interruption. Yeah. So I kept on speaking. And because of me speaking, my mother was trying to leave Pakistan. They attacked her. They abducted her. And she's now kept in Pakistan, not allowed to leave the country. Her passport has been blocked, irrespective of the high court orders. They are not removing her passport from the block list. My passports, my identities were cancelled. My immediate family's IDs, national IDs, were cancelled. My assets in Pakistan, I had quite a lot of assets there because I was a successful businessman as well. I was doing a real estate business with the military, and the military runs all the businesses in my country, in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. So I was a very successful businessman over there. All my assets were seized, my bank accounts were seized. They came with a strategic lawsuit against public participation in the UK. But before that, they got me arrested on the counterterrorism case here in the UK. And they got me arrested and they got me investigated from the UK counterterrorism police for 9 months. And the investigation ended in no further action because I was being blamed for incitement of violence in the Pakistan through my journalism. I became a member.
Just before you carry on, I just want to ask you about Imran Khan and the Kashmir issue, because it seems he was very outspoken. This is a sore point which was left there, I wonder, deliberately by Mountbatten, who was the last Viceroy of India, as a kind of running sore, really, between India and Pakistan. And Imran Khan was absolutely adamant about there being a peaceful settlement there. He believed that the people of Kashmir should be able to decide their own fate, that there should be a plebiscite of some sort. And he was very outspoken about this on the world stage. So I wonder, maybe you could tell us a bit about, give us a bit of an insight into what many people simply knew as a cricketer who had become the Prime Minister of Pakistan, and, you know, why he was so targeted.
Yeah, Tony, before we move on to the transnational repression, here in the UK, hitmen were hired to kill, to attack me, and they've been charged.
I want to do this before we do that, if you don't mind. Sorry.
So Imran Khan came to power based upon his political ideology, but Imran Khan, the way power dynamics work in Pakistan, he was never in charge. The actual control was always with the military, and the military had decided to abandon the Kashmir cause. Why? Let me show you a few seconds clip of the army chief, General Kiani's statement, whilst it's a video where he's talking to the senior commanders and the commanding officers of the military. Just have a look.
One has completely transformed or changed various equations. We cannot have the same understanding pre-9/11 and after 9/11. What is the freedom struggle before 9/11, after 9/11, it is called something differently. We still believe the freedom struggle in Kashmir is a freedom struggle. But if you get nobody's support, so we have to adjust accordingly. I don't mean to say that we abandon because there is our national interest.
So there you go. We abandon Kashmir because the generals decided that it is in our national interest to abandon the Kashmir cause. So there goes the answer. But once Imran Khan came into power, the army chief was General Bajwa. After General Kiani, the army chief was General Rahil Sharif, and then there was another army chief. But the policy of the military was always the one which have been dictated right over here by the army chief, General Ashfaq Parvez Kiani, who was the army chief for 6 years, right? So the policy is quite clear. Rest all are optics. But Imran Khan believed that he is in charge, and he believed that there needs to be a just solution to Kashmir. And that is why he defied and he tried to get the foreign policy in his hand, which constitutionally should be governed by the foreign minister and the prime minister. But in Pakistan, it is under the command of the Pakistani military, under the authority of Pakistani military. They've got the security policy and the foreign policy in their hand. And of course, they are also, they've got the entire government in their hand because they've got to run their billion-dollar businesses. They've got a net worth of around $200 billion worth of military incorporated businesses.
So who is making these decisions about Kashmir? Because it doesn't seem to be in Pakistan national interest for the army to just abandon it. You know, this seems to be who makes decisions like this?
Yeah, well, that is the fundamental problem with Pakistan, that the individual interest or the Western interest of the generals and a group of elite kleptocrats is described as national interest. And the generals and the kleptocracy on the top decided that, well, it is in our national interest to abandon the Kashmir cause, and they did abandon the Kashmir cause as a result. And even now, the Pakistani generals, the one at the top, Asim Munir, he decided that this is in my benefit to go and follow this policy. Mm. And then they portray it as a national interest. So there is no, there are no institutions left in Pakistan. And only institution they say is the Pakistani military. Well, the Pakistani military, you know, work on the whims of one man. It's a one-man rule by design. Ever since Pakistan was created, Field Marshal Ayub Khan introduced Article 199, Clause 1 and 3 in the Pakistan Army Act, which empowers the army chief to, you know, just with a single signature, without any explanation, he can fire any military personnel, any general, any colonel, any military personnel through an administrative action, and it cannot be challenged in any code of law. So there you go. You've made him all, and you give him absolute power, and absolute power makes an absolute corrupt man.
Because it seems to me that this cause of Imran Khan, whether it's the military or the people running Pakistan, is really part of your cause. And while you're here in London and not back home in Pakistan today, so could you just resume the story? Because I know you've been being targeted over Christmas specifically, and the police have got involved.
Yeah, so the attacks kept on going, and my security protocols were very high because most of my earnings, almost all of it goes to implementing those security protocols, which is quite difficult. But after the counterterrorism case, they went through a static lawsuit against public participation. They've been trying to attack me ever since, and there have been active intelligence and reports which I've been sharing, and I'm grateful to the Thames Valley Police and the Metropolitan Police and the Counterterrorism Command, particularly the Counterterrorism Police Southeast and SO15 as well, who were actively protecting me. I was listening to their advice. That's why I escaped the attack on the New Year Eve last month. And it was a planned attack. These are not my words. These are the words of the Crown Prosecution Service, that a sophisticated and planned attack was carried out. by a university student of Canterbury Christchurch University, a BSU honors student of with no prior convictions. He was the masterman, and he was paid to do it. And the judge corrected the chief magistrate of Westminster's Magistrates Court, characterized it as a hitman for hire for violence. That guy was hired for violence, and he further employed a number of individuals. Three out of them have been charged. The mastermind have been charged recently, last week, in the magistrates, Westminster Magistrates Court, and they're still held in custody, and they've been denied bail. A total of 7 arrests were made. Obviously, we all know who is behind it, because, you know, who could be the paymaster. Because of my whistleblowing, because of my journalistic investigative journalism, I've been leaking secret documents. I've been talking about human rights violation, gross human rights violations, unheard of human rights violation by the Pakistani military and the Pakistani puppet regime. So obviously, we know who could be the paymaster, because who is spending millions of pounds on lawfare against me? Well, there you go. The proof is in the pudding anyway. But they attacked us. They attacked not only me, but my fellow colleague, Barrister Shahzad Akbar. He lives in Cambridge. Now, this is interesting, because 2 teams were deployed. One team attacked my house, and the other team at this very same time, 8 a.m. in the morning, the second team attacked Barrister Shahzad Akbar. He was at home. So the guy asked him, are you Shahzad Akbar? The attacker asked him. He confirmed, yes, I am. He was wearing a high visibility jacket, and he was wearing a baklava mask, and he had started attacking him. He hit him 30 times, and he broke his nose and his jaw as well. And his wife and small little kids, the angels, the kindergarten kids, and one is a bit older, but they're still very small kids. They pushed the attacker out and they closed the door, but that was not the only attack. A week after that, they attacked his house again. 3 shots were fired at his home, and then they tried to burn down the house. And a week after that, the third attack on the 10th of January of this month occurred. And what they did in that attack was that they made racist graffiti over there. So the police took it as a challenge, and the police declared that it was a coordinated attack. Initially, I didn't know there is a coordinated attack, but the police informed me about the attack. I wasn't here in I wasn't at my address. I wasn't in the UK even. I wasn't in England. So I was called up, and I was told by the police on the 26th of December that there had been a break-in. I said, fine. So, but later on, police investigation revealed that it was a coordinated attack on the 24th of December on me and Shahzad Akbar on Christmas Eve. And the investigation was taken over by the Counterterrorism Command, by SO15 of the Metropolitan Police. And within a month, that's a record time, they've charged 4 people with the sophisticated and planned attack. So who could be the paymaster, Tony? I ask you this question. Who do you think is doing all this? These are British men. These are Irish British men. All right.
I'd just like to say, because the case is still ongoing, that the police have arrested people who are alleged to have carried out these attacks. I don't think there's any doubt that they happened, but we are looking at possible people who did it, and of suspects who are now held in custody and are now being charged, but they still haven't been convicted. So I think just we ought to make clear that it may be that the police have got the wrong people. Let's look at that. Obviously, this is pressure coming from Pakistan, and these people seem to think that the British police, Scotland Yard, don't exist, Adil.
Yeah, but they were mocking the British authorities. They were thinking that the British, like one of the dissidents who've been, the Pakistani state gave me last month, gave me 2 life sentences. Before that, they court-martialed me in absentia, being a former military officer, for my work, for my journalistic work in the UK, and for the violation of Official Secret Act, they awarded 14-year rigorous imprisonment to me. And last month, the Pakistani leading journalists in exile were given 2 life sentences and 35-year on top of it, each, by anti-terrorist court.
How is this affecting you? I mean, are you managing to take it on the chin? Are you still fighting fit?
Well, let me add that before that, I was given the singular honor, and I'm being satirical over here. I was given the singular honor of being proscribed on Schedule 4, which is the anti-terror watch list of Pakistan, right? So obviously, Donis, I am taking it on the chin. I've been a fighter throughout my life. My brand is Soldier Speaks. I started fighting as a soldier from a gun. The transition from a gun to a pen is quite obvious, but I'm still a fighter. I'm fighting on. That is why the brand Soldier Speaks. And I am speaking truth to power. And there's a cost to be paid. And I knew there'll be a cost to be paid. And I am paying that cost. My entire family is paying that cost. But it is taking a heavy toll on me, obviously. It's a struggle every day. And the damages are quite obvious, but I don't brag about it. I don't talk about it. I don't need to talk about it. The fight is on. And once the fight is on, you don't think about how it's going to end. You just need to fight back. And I'm fighting for the poor people. I'm fighting for the human rights of my country.
Yeah. Well, anyway, if people are interested in finding or follow you, you mentioned Soldier Speaks. Where's the best place for people to find you?
Yeah, so if you want to follow my YouTube channel at Soldier Speaks Reloaded, the government got my YouTube channel banned for 2.5 years, but thanks to the National Union of Journalists, I'm back on. So if you want to follow me, you can follow me on Soldier Speaks Reloaded is my main channel. And then if you want to follow me on my English channel, it's Soldier Speaks English is my English channel. Or just, you know, soldierspeaks.org is my website. You'll find all the links over there. And my Twitter handle is at soldierspeaks. You can find me over there as well.
Okay, Adil Raja, thanks very much for joining us again. And we'll keep an eye on this little court case of yours.
Thank you, Tony.